doctor shortages in a United States which would soon be unable to handle the coronavirus pandemic. It also put a pause on the so-called brain drain, which allows America to stay near the forefront of science and technology. Trump's dehumanizing of Muslims followed years of scapegoating in order to rationalize the wars across the Muslim world started by Trump's predecessors, George W. Bush and Barack Obama. Perhaps above all, the ban showed that in the American system, it is still possible to codify racism into law. The Supreme Court reversed a series of lower court decisions which allowed the ban to go into effect. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The emergence of fast-spreading coronavirus variants has once again put a spotlight on the role of children in the COVID-19 pandemic. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Deanne Louise Ryder. This article is published under the heading, What New COVID Variants Mean for Schools is Not Yet Clear. Stay tuned for the details, please. The emergence of fast-spreading coronavirus variants has once again put a spotlight on the role of children in the COVID-19 pandemic. Early data on one new variant had suggested that it was spreading more in children than in adults compared with other lineages. But researchers now suggest the variant is spreading more efficiently in all age groups, allaying those fears. Still, a year into the pandemic, much remains unknown about the spread of SARS-CoV-2 in children, prompting calls for increased surveillance and testing to inform decisions about school closures. We still don't really know how much schools and children actually contribute to spread, says Catherine Bennett, an epidemiologist at Deakin University in Melbourne. Children seem to be less susceptible to SARS-CoV-2 than adults are, possibly because of inherent biological differences, says Callum Semple, an outbreak specialist at the University of Liverpool, UK. And studies in schools in several countries last year suggested that campuses were not hot spots for transmission, provided they took precautions such as maintaining hygiene and social distancing. However, that often aren't easily comparable between countries because of the variation in practices. But if the new variant is increasing infection rates in children, then the dynamics of transmission in schools should be reinvestigated, says Bennett. Better data are needed because cases in children who more often experience asymptomatic infections are probably being missed. Countries often test only people with symptoms. Many researchers caution against closing the schools before other parts of society, noting the harm to children from missed learning. Other scientists think that governments should act quickly when there is a rise in infections, including closing the schools. George Miles, who leads COVID-19 modeling at the University of Western Australia in Perth, says it's better to go hard early and then relax. The new variant, now called B117, was first detected in the United Kingdom in November. Data collected between late November and mid-December suggested that children were being infected with B117 compared with other known lineages, more so than people in other age groups. This prompted suggestions the variant was spreading in children more easily than in adults. But a January report from Public Health England, a government public health agency, found that the variant, which has spread to dozens of countries, transmits more easily in all age groups. It also found that children, especially those under the age of 10, are about half as likely as adults to transmit the variant to others. A similar picture is emerging about another fast-spreading variant, which was first detected in South Africa and is known as 501YV2, says Richard Lessels, an infectious diseases specialist at the University of KwaZulu-Natal in Durban. There is nothing jumping out at us that there is different outcomes in the younger groups, he says. If children do account for a greater proportion of new COVID infections in the United Kingdom, that could be partly because schools stayed open when workplaces and retail outlets were closed at the end of last year, says Semple. Estimates suggest that children are half as susceptible to SARS-CoV-2 infection as adults, and some researchers suggest their biology could be one reason why. Semple says this could be because of differences in the number and location of ACE2 receptors in the respiratory tract. These receptors are used by the virus to latch on host cells. Children are thought to have fewer ACE2 receptors than adults have. And whereas adults have these receptors throughout their airways, children might have them only in the upper respiratory tract, says Semple. This could explain why the virus doesn't seem to take hold in young children. Three recently identified variants have been found with mutations to spike protein, which the virus uses to latch onto cells, making the variants better able to infect host respiratory cells. But Semple says children might always be less susceptible than adults to an infection that uses ACE2 receptor, although that needs to be investigated. Other researchers have suggested that children might be better protected against unfamiliar pathogens than are adults because they have a more receptive and responsive innate immune system and higher numbers of naive immune T cells. But more evidence is needed to establish whether this is the case. In light of the increased infections in children, more accurate data on how they transmit the virus is needed, including how many close contacts children infect compared to adults, says Bennett. Seroprevalence surveys could also check for evidence of previous infection, says Kim Mulholland, a pediatrician at the Murdoch Children Research Institute in Melbourne, Australia. There has been at least one report of children developing antibodies to SARS-CoV-2 despite not testing positive in a standard diagnostic test that detects viral RNA. The findings suggest that the children mounted a rapid local immune response, but that their viral shedding was too low for tests to pick up, says Mulholland, who co-authored the report. But Mulholland cautions against knee-jerk reactions to early and incomplete information about increased transmission of recent variants in children. The cost of school closures in terms of lost education, potential exposure to abuse, and in some countries, the premature end to schooling in favor of work or marriage could have devastating social impacts that blight a generation of children. A report last October by the charity Save the Children predicted that, by the end of 2020, 500,000 more children globally than usual would have been forced into marriage, and 1 million more would have become pregnant as an indirect result of COVID-19. These social problems are going to be persisting, he says. Bennett, too, says closing the schools can have unintended consequences. Keeping kids at home can increase household transmission if parents bring babysitters into their homes, she says.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Certain points about economic problems. The necessity to channel the money flow towards production.
This is part of a televised speech delivered on July 31st, 2020 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader of the Islamic Revolution on the occasion of Eid al-Adha.
Other necessary issue, which can also be done according to experts, is the issue of channeling the money flow towards production. Of course, 2 years ago, I said it in my Eid al-Fitr sermon that the money flow is a grave danger for the economy of the country. But this danger could be turned into profit. If we can guide it towards production with correct measures, then not only will it not be harmful, but it will also be profitable. Experts say that this is possible, but it requires planning and follow-up. By Allah's favor, such measures should be implemented.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need, my Lord. Protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
Another issue is about the obstacles in the way of surge in production. I have named this year the year of bringing about a surge in production. But there are certain hurdles on this path. I have received a proposal in this regard and I will mention it here. The honorable heads of the three branches of government should pursue and study this proposal. It has been suggested that the heads of the three branches appoint a special team, the representatives of the heads of the three branches, so that it will try to identify and eliminate these obstacles. The heads of the three branches should discuss this in their meeting and reach a certain conclusion. They should seriously pursue the matter and see what the obstacles in the way of a surge in production are. Perhaps one of these obstacles is unnecessary imports, which is very important.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
As President Biden signs a national mask mandate into law, measures being imposed in the name of protecting public health could create a humanitarian crisis that sees Americans sued by the state and forced into detention camps for breaking pandemic protocols, says Raul Diego, writer, in an article published under the heading, Experts Warn U.S. Civil Rights Fallout from COVID Could Be Far Worse Than the Pandemic Itself. Stay tuned for the details, please. The very first executive order Joe Biden signed upon becoming the 46th president of the United States was the national mask mandate he promised at the Democratic National Convention back in August. The order masks that makes face coverings and social distancing mandatory in all federal property and a legal requisite for interstate commerce. The move signals a clear intent on the part of his administration to double down on the authoritarian emergency measures, as described in a recent paper from Oxford University, implemented in the wake of the pandemic crisis, and sets the stage for what may be the greatest threat to human rights and civil liberties the world has ever known. Under the cover of a public health emergency, the U.S. government has imposed a litany of authoritarian measures to to curb freedom of movement, assembly, and association. Even academia has now begun to examine the risks these measures pose to the rights enshrined in the international treaties like the American Convention on Human Rights or Pact of San Jose, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and the Arab Charter on Human Rights, among others. A study published in Oxford University's Journal of Law and Biosciences explores how these restrictions are leading the world down a path of totalitarian rule that threatens to eviscerate decades of hard-won social progress through the expansion of surveillance and the excessive and disproportionate application of emergency measures across different countries. The researchers exposed troubling examples of how governments have availed themselves of indefinite curfews, quarantines, and public humiliation to target migrants or other marginalized populations, which the authors judge to be are far beyond what would be necessary to contain and slow the spread of COVID-19, and in some cases bear little relation to that otherwise legitimate public health objective. Additionally, the study's authors underline the need for a more common-sense approach and decry the Wuhan-inspired all-or-nothing approach or to viral containment, setting a dangerous precedent for future pandemics and disasters, with a global copycat response indicating an impending pandemic of a different sort, that of authoritarianism, with a gratitude toll being inflicted on democracy, civil liberties, fundamental freedoms, healthcare ethics, and human dignity. This has the potential to unleash humanitarian crises no less devastating than COVID-19 in the long run. Reports out of Germany confirm that at least four states in the European nation are in the process of setting up detention camps for repeat offenders of that country's health protocols. Rule breakers will be held in facilities especially built for the purpose in three of the German localities, while a refugee camp will be used to hold offenders in the eastern state of Saxony, considered to be a bastion of xenophobic and neo-Nazi sentiment by other German states, according to Al Jazeera. The idea that such extreme method could come to the United States probably hasn't crossed the mind of most Americans. After all, many still believe in a system of checks and balances that is designed to prevent such egregious outreach by the government. But the trend is very clear for anyone who has been paying attention. And more significantly, the legal prerequisites are already in place for such an eventuality. As one unsuspecting veteran of the U.S. Navy would come to find out, and which, according to constitutional attorney John W. Whitehead and founder of the Rutherford Institute, allows the government to rescind the Fourth Amendment rights, removing the people's right to be secure in their homes and protect against unreasonable searches and seizures, to name just one of the issues his story presents. What Frank Peterson, whose name has been changed to protect his identity, thought would be a relatively quick visit to the local VA emergency room to deal with a couple of broken ribs turned into a shocking revelation about just how far the U.S. he served has come to losing the freedoms that he and generations of his family before him enlisted to defend. Frank endured broken ribs before and thought he could toughets out at home. Earlier that day, he and his fiancée had been driving back from the suburbs when they came across a terrible car accident. Always one to help, he pulled over and tried to check on the driver. The tow truck that had slammed into a tree at the bottom of a ravine. In the process of trying to put out a fire that had ignited inside in the vehicle, Frank crushed his ribcage while rolling down the big gully with a fire extinguisher. The pain was too intense to sleep off, and by 2 a.m., he thought better of it and headed down to 1101 Veterans Doctor in Lexington, Kentucky, for treatment at the VA healthcare facility. Frank informed them he had been feeling a bit under the weather. A slight cough and some fatigue. Following protocol, he was administered a COVID-19 test and given a general rundown of the precautions he should take while he waited for the results, which came back positive a few days later. Along with the results came the Lexington Fayette County's Health Department and an isolation order requiring Frank's signature. The remarkable document sent to him via email stipulates the responsibilities he, as a source of infection of and a communicable disease, must adhere to during the 14-day self-quarantine period. These include having prior approval of the LFCHD in order to leave the county, receive visitors, travel by any public, commercial, or healthcare conveyance, and numerous other restrictions. While these stipulations are certainly problematic on their own, the most egregious encroachment upon civil liberties is reserved for the last two bullet points, which state that should Frank be found to be in violation of any one of the aforementioned requisites, the LFCHD can file a lawsuit against him in the state circuit court, and in addition, reserves the right to re-evaluate this order prior to determining when the isolation period may be lifted. Frank has since been released from self-isolation, but as he told me in press news, he never signed the document, which Whitehead considers to be the best protection he could have afforded himself under the circumstances. Had Frank signed the isolation order, he would have waived all of his constitutional rights and could have potentially faced criminal charges, according to Mr. Whitehead, who spoke to Mint Press about his situation and the terrifying implications for all Americans. The judicial basis for the power currently accumulating in the hands of the biopharma cartels and their agents in the U.S. government, like Acting Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response Robert Cadley, comes from the landmark Jacobson v. Massachusetts case of 1905 that upheld the state's rights to enforce compulsory vaccination laws. The Supreme Court's decision created a perfect loophole that allowed abrogation of all constitutional rights, ruling that individual liberty was not absolute and subject to the police power of the state in the case of a public police health emergency. The seminal decision has never been successfully challenged in the lower courts since, and is the precedent that underpins the statutes cited in Frank Peterson isolation order of the applicable Kentucky state and county codes. It is the state statutes that allow such a draconian order to be enforced, including arrest and criminal charges. It is deeply entrenched in American law that with a health crisis like this, the government has what's called a compelling state interest to protect the general safety of the public. Whitehead explains, adding that this particular judicial principle raises the question of whether Americans have any rights at all that cannot be emancipated. Indeed, emergency powers have served as the backbone of the American executive branch throughout the first two decades of the 21st century. A global pandemic is nothing less than the mother of all emergencies in which rights can be suspended indefinitely through long-established legal devices that seem to lie dormant in obscure law tomes, only to be weaponized at this very moment in history. The bill's language is unambiguous, stating clearly that upon determining by clear and convincing evidence that the health nine of others is or may be endangered by a case, contact or carrier or suspected case, contact or carrier of a contagious disease, the governor or his or her delegee, including but not limited to the commissioner or the heads of local health departments, may order the removal and or detention of such a person or of a group of such persons by issuing a single order. While mainstream publications in the U.S. have tried to downplay the bill's significance and throw around terms like conspiracy theories to dissuade readers from taking warnings by the bill's opponents seriously, it doesn't take a tinfoil to see which way the wind is blowing and for Assembly Bill A-416 to move from committee to the floor of the state Senate and onto the desk of Governor Cuomo. If such a bill were passed and signed in the state of New York or elsewhere, people like Frank Peterson, who refused to sign an isolation order or quite simply flouted the new mask mandate signed into law by President Biden, could be rounded up and sent to a detention camp. As Whitehead has been warning, these measures will be enforced by a militarized police, which have been steadily growing stronger in the United States for years and which could very well end up merging with federal law enforcement agencies as the related push for domestic terrorism laws come into play.
The debate.
Hello, welcome to the debate. I'm Kavita Tapwai. Scotland has called for another independence referendum. Meanwhile, the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has said that he will be visiting Scotland soon to see if he can have this separatism rejected. Question is, with the UK itself suffering from an economic downturn, COVID-19 and Brexit, can it make its case? Meanwhile, the former Prime Minister Gordon Brown has said that the UK may become a failed state. First, let's get more on this story from Rob Carter, who's a correspondent joining us from London. Rob Carter, obviously, we have on the one hand the Scotland's independence bid to come into the picture again. Of course, then what the former Prime Minister Gordon Brown has said, if you can forge those into one quick response, please.
Sure. Well, obviously, Gordon Brown has issued a stark warning here. The reasons behind his warning are essentially, bottom line, that many people across the UK just simply do not trust Westminster. They do not believe that politicians are competent enough to run things, and there seems to be a huge identity crisis growing across the kingdom. Obviously, as you've mentioned, there are independence movements springing up, and they seem to have increasing amounts of success, particularly in Scotland and Wales, but also in the north of Ireland. Unification push is at an all-time popular height, according to polls, but also the economic damage caused by Brexit and the COVID pandemic. With all of these things, spiraling out of control, it seems, many years in the future, we could see a very disunited kingdom, if a united kingdom actually exists at all. So a stark warning from the former prime minister, which may seem a bit over the top for the time being, but when people's livelihoods are struggling and they lose hope financially, which as we've seen is happening now, then of course things could look very different in the future, possibly lead to some kind of dissent. But the future of the UK could be the next big crisis that this kingdom faces in the very near future.
Thank you for that, Rob Carter. We appreciate it. Let me bring in author and commentator John White, who joins us from Edinburgh. John White, welcome. We're looking at the referendum call again from Scotland, the First Minister to call it. Tell us about the significance of this timing, if you can, and what that spells for the UK at this point in time. Okay, Derek Conway, who joins us from London. He's a former MP and presenter. Derek, let me address this question to you then.
I think the United Kingdom is far stronger if the nations that make it up stick together. But I think we have to face the fact that the younger generation want their politicians to be more accountable. Really doesn't matter which country you're in. And they want decision-making to be nearer to them. So if you're a young person living in Scotland, Westminster and its raging old Etonians like Boris Johnson seem light years away. You might as well be governed from the moon. And each year about 55,000 people in Scotland of my age group are dying, and 55,000 young people are becoming eligible to vote. And so the change in opinion about whether Scotland remains part of the UK as it has been for 300 years or goes it alone is going very much in favour of those who want to see it break away from the rest of the United Kingdom.
Okay, now we do have John White joining us from Edinburgh, author and commentator. John White, Nicola Sturgeon says that she hopes for a strong performance by her Scottish National Party in an election in May. That's going to give her the mandate to hold a second referendum. Is doing so within her mandate?
Absolutely, it is within her mandate. The mandate was actually achieved with the Brexit vote when in which 62% of Scots, which translates to every one of Scotland's 32 local authorities, voted to remain. And the idea that we can be ripped out of the EU against our democratic wish and will by a significant majority is anathema to the very principle of democracy. So for me, this prolonged experiment in semi-feudalism at home and colonialism abroad is nearing its end, and high time too. This country is not fit for purpose. 100,000 and counting COVID deaths tells its own grim story in this regard. We have a Tory government that is more akin to a death cult pretending to be a government. It's every utterance at the start of this crisis back in February, March was made with the health of the economy rather than the public in mind. And since then, we have suffered from its criminal negligence. And I think that Scotland's independence is a matter of when, not if.
Well, Derek Conway, former Prime Minister Gordon Brown, seems to think otherwise. He's saying that the Scottish National Party would have a democratic mandate to hold a referendum on Scottish independence, that he did not think that the SNP actually has that mandate. Why is he saying that? And this is, of course, saying he also said that if it wins May's Scottish elections as expected.
Well, politicians, and he's a former prime minister, although he's a different political party to me, and I was with him for 25 years in the House of Commons, and we all dance around on pinheads. I think it's ironic your other contributor would want to go away from being a fiefdom of Westminster to being a fiefdom of Brussels, but I think there is a basic point that when in 2014 the Scottish people decided by quite a clear margin to remain within the United Kingdom was then within the European Union. Now that we've left the European Union, I think the moral case for saying the Scottish people are entitled to a say again is quite strong. I mean, at the time, everybody said that 6 years ago that this was a vote for a generation. Well, 6 years is clearly not a generation. But the ground rules have changed because of our withdrawal from the European Union. So I think, although Westminster wants this issue to go away, and Boris Johnson will use every trick in the book to avoid having a referendum on this matter while he's still Prime Minister. I think the fact remains that the mood in Scotland will just grow stronger and stronger. Personally, I think they're wrong. I think it would be a great shame. And I think the next generation Scotland will pay bitterly for those with deep chips on their shoulder who are very happy to take a very large amount of support from the English taxpayer but aren't quite so happy to stay any longer part of the Union. And they'll find the world is very cold outside the UK.
All right. Well, John White, the reports indicate that Prime Minister Boris Johnson is going to be traveling to Scotland to see if he can make it his case. But he's going to be going on very shaky grounds, basically looking at what's happening with the UK, you're talking about coronavirus, talking about an economy that is reported not to go through double-dip recession. What can Boris Johnson say to Nicola Sturgeon to avoid this from happening, as it's called a separation?
Well, for a majority of people in Scotland, Boris Johnson and his ilk is the virus. That is the real virus that is the root cause of all the ill that facing Scottish society. This is a prime minister, this is a political party that's presided over record levels of poverty, child hunger, homelessness, rough sleeping. They are taking Britain on a rocket ship to hell. These people are lost in the mists of time. They're consumed with British obscurantism. The Brexit is an emotional reach back in time to a supposed golden age when Britannia ruled the waves and the Union Jack flew wherever it damn well pleased. And Derek is wrong. He is the one who's about to find out that the world is a cold place outside the largest free trading bloc in the world. And we're already seeing that. Ask small businesses if Brexit is a good idea. We are suffering the dead weight of added bureaucracy and costs. Ask the fishing industry. Ask hauliers if Brexit is a good idea. Ask the 3 million workers whose employment was dependent on Britain's membership of the single market. This is what happens when theory meets reality. And as I say, there's nothing so powerful as an idea whose time has come. And the idea of the breakup of the UK is very much an idea whose time has come. Boris Johnson has got nothing to say to Nicola Sturgeon other than set a date, because it's clear now that the momentum is towards Scottish independence. And if Boris Johnson tries to deny the democratic right of the Scottish people, who are a partner nation in the UK, not a province, as Tories would have us believe, then he is headed for a sticky wicket, because he will then become the greatest friend that Scottish independence could have and the worst enemy that the UK could have.
Well, I'm going to use again Derek Conway. First of all, do you have a response to what our guest John White has, Derek Conway?
Well, I think there's a big assumption in that contribution, which is if Scotland leaves the United Kingdom, it can automatically rejoin the European Union. And I don't think that's a given by any stretch of the imagination, because the balance of the Scottish economy would not fit with the requirements of the European Union as they presently stand. And so it's a question of whether the European Union would want to take on yet another country that would be a taker of resources rather than a giver of resources. And you can bet your bottom dollar that the Spaniards, for example, will have a very strong view on that, because they don't want to give any encouragement to the bits of Spain that would like to break away and be independent. The Catalonia movement will be watching very closely what happens. And so I think Spain would almost certainly use its veto to say to Scotland, well, no, you're not coming back in. You're part of the UK and you've got to make your own way in the world. And then Scotland will find itself an extraordinarily small nation in a big globe. I mean, yes, Britain may have interesting challenges ahead on the Brexit. We'll have to wait and see. But at the end of the day, it is 67 million people, and that's a big bit of economic clout, whereas Scotland would not be anywhere near in that league. So there are many people in England, actually, wish they could have a vote in the referendum, and there are many people in England who would be saying, well, if that's how you feel, off you go and get on with it. And I think the attitude of Scotland to public expenditure, for example, will come under very, very heavy pressure if they didn't have the weight of the English economy and the City of London, which we all hate and loathe and mock bankers, but at the end of the day, they generate an awful lot of tax revenue. And that's what pays for all the social measures that our friend is arguing for, and I agree with much that he says, but I don't think it's quite as straightforward. This is a decision made on resentment for the past and chips on shoulders about old Etonians. Then it'll be very short-judged indeed.
John White, is it true the way that Scotland was just painted by our guest there, Derek Conway?
No, this is what English nationalists would have us believe, that Scotland is not big enough or rich enough or smart enough or resourceful enough to go its own way. This is not about what is easy. This is not going to be easy. Nobody's stupid enough to think so. This is about what is necessary. Scottish independence is now a lifeboat. Derek talks about the tax. The fact is, we don't have a just tax system in this country. The rich are not taxed nearly enough compared to their wealth. We have rising levels of inequality. This country is not fit for purpose, as I've said previously. Lack of social and economic justice, food banks, demand spiralling. This pandemic, the way the government's handled it, the fact that we were unprepared to deal with it, this is the fruits of 40 years of Tory party free market ideology. When Margaret Thatcher said infamously that there is no such thing as society, 40 years on, we can see that this was not a statement of fact, it was a statement of intent. And her successors have done their damn best to make that come to pass. That is why we are suffering such grievous mortality, such grievous crisis in the wake of this pandemic. And as I say, it's time for Scotland to go its own way. Scotland is more than capable of going its own way. You don't judge a country by the size of its population or the size of its economy. You judge a country by the size of its idea. And the idea that underpins the majority strain of Scottish independence is social and economic justice.
John's emotion is perfectly reasonable, and I have a considerable amount of sympathy with what he's saying. But at the end of the day, sometimes economics overrules emotion. And like him, you know, let's mock the super rich. I've got no time for them, why should I? But the fact is that 1% of the richest people in the United Kingdom contribute 26% of the government's income. So it's all right to say to the people, oh, take your richness and your yachts and your big houses and go somewhere else. But when they take their money somewhere else, where does that income come from? And what Scotland would find, of course, is many of its richest people would disappear. And then the government would find itself more than a quarter short of the money it wants to spend on very good and deserving budgets. So a degree of economic reality has to come into it. And that's what happened in 2014. But I think the emotions will be very different when there actually is another referendum, which I reckon would probably be in the next 2 years. And Scotland will then have to find out if it's quite as easy as people are leading them to believe.
So the economic consequences would be great, as our guest there explained, John White, if you agree with him, like his Derek Conway's statement of 1% that contribute to 26% there. I mean, is that the reality?
No, it's not. If the economic consequences of staying in this union are even greater, call me old-fashioned, I'm an old-fashioned lefty, I would introduce a ban on capital flight. The rich can go wherever they damn well please, but their money stays here, because after all, they made their money in this country. They made their money from the public realm, i.e. the public education system for their workers, the road system, the infrastructure, etc., etc. So they can go wherever they want, but their money will stay here to be invested in...
No, it won't. They tried that, you know, when Harold Wilson was Prime Minister in Britain back in the 60s.
I'm just laying out here the vision of an independent Scotland that I aspire to. I understand that's not the SNP's vision. I'm not a supporter of the SNP. I'm just giving you my aspiration to show that there is another way. This is not the best of all
possible worlds. The internet stops all that, John. The internet stops that. When Harold Wilson was Prime Minister, he had controls of taking your money out of the country. But then there weren't computers in those days. Today, when the Scottish referendum is due to be announced at 10 o'clock in the evening, at 10 to 10, anybody with serious sums of money will simply press a button on their computer keyboard and the money will be gone. And it's saying we're going to stop them taking their money, we'll teach them. It won't be there. It'll be long gone. That's what was going to happen when Jeremy Corbyn nearly became Prime Minister. Banks had whole teams of people working for their richest clients who would have had their money out of the country before the 10 o'clock news announced that he'd become Prime Minister. And that's a serious concern if you're trying to balance the books in the Treasury.
Well, this race to the bottomism is part of the problem, isn't it? And it's not just about the tax revenue. That's not the way our government generates money. We have our own central bank. I advocate Scotland to become part of the European Economic Area so that we can have our own central bank and our own currency so that we can print our own money. That is the way ahead. MMT, modern monetary theory. We don't have to rely on tax revenue alone. We can print our own money via central bank, and we can use that to invest in public services, in jobs, and in the future. That is the way ahead as far as I'm concerned. As I go back to
the next generation.
I go back to what I said earlier. This is not the best of all possible worlds, and on the contrary, this is the worst of all possible worlds. There is an alternative, and the Chinese have shown that alternative, which is sustainability, managed capitalism, not in terms of the politics, but in terms of their approach to the economy.
Very well. We've got just a few minutes left. I get a feeling you're not a real fan of former Prime Minister Gordon Brown, Derek Conway, but I have to ask your reaction to what he has said, because it's pretty eye-opening. For example, how he said dissatisfaction is so deep in Scotland that it threatens the end of the United Kingdom. Do you agree?
I think so. I mean, Gordon Brown's a perfectly decent man. I don't think he was a very impressive prime minister. He was a much better chancellor of the Exchequer. So I don't have any quarrel with Gordon Brown as an individual. And I think on this, he's probably quite right. I mean, the trouble is that the SNP in Scotland are very popular. They've pretty well wiped out the Labour Party. The Conservative Party is now the second political party in Scotland. And Nicola Sturgeon, their first minister, seems to be very, very popular with people. And so I think, as in all things, politics is personality. And if I were a Scotsman, I wouldn't like Boris Johnson and his old Etonian accents and his posh friends and all of the things that would make the average Scotsman go, oh, I don't want that running me. And so the balance of personalities is not good at the moment. So I think the United Kingdom is in some danger. But I think if the United Kingdom were to break up, which would in essence just be Scotland going, I think Wales and Ireland would stay with England, then I think they would still be a very, very strong economic entity and free of the shackles of Brussels, which in Edinburgh they want to wrap themselves around again. I think the contrast would be very startling. Never forget that Venezuela had the fourth richest oil reserves in the world, and look at the state of their economy now. So even with lots of money, politicians can still make a mess of things.
Okay. Last question, I think, is going to go to you, John White. When you take a look at the whole situation concerning the UK, Scotland, and the EU, what do you foresee in order to give us your picture as to what we're looking down in the future here?
Well, when historians come to analyze this period, they will mine a poetic irony, which is that rather than the harbinger of a new golden age, which Brexiteers argued it would be, Brexit is the last brick in the wall of this 19th century colonial theme park. Scottish independence, as I say, is now certain. It's an out and about the political struggle to make it happen. Boris Johnson and his rancid Tory establishment will not be minded to issue a Section 30. The last referendum was too close to call, and Boris Johnson, or whoever succeeds him, if he does decide to resign, as some people are saying he's going to do, but if it's Boris Johnson, he will not want his legacy to be dominated by the fact that he is a prime minister who, quote unquote, lost Scotland. The Scottish independence is nigh. It's been a long time coming. The cultural differences, the political differences across the regions and the constituent nations of this state are far too great and far too far-reaching. And the crisis at the heart of the British state is only being accelerated by COVID. So, as I say, Scottish independence will happen. It will not be easy. Nobody should be delusional to think it would be, but it's not about what is easy at this juncture in history. It's about what is